Welcome to Deadly Connections, the true crime podcast with Dr. Timo Schuller.
It's just past 2 in the morning. The intensive care unit rests in the dim light of the night shift. Somewhere, a monitor beeps in steady rhythm. The air smells like disinfectant, that particular, faintly sharp mixture you don't smell anywhere else. And once you have, you never forget. Dieter is 63, retired. He had been looking forward to retirement, to his garden, to traveling with his wife, to all the things he had been putting off for years. He's been here for a few days now, but he's getting better. Tomorrow maybe, the doctor said. Soon. He's half asleep. He hears footsteps. Calm. Familiar footsteps. The footsteps of someone who belongs here. Who knows every corner of this place. Who comes and goes at night without alarming anyone. The door opens. Brief flash of light. Then dark again. Someone steps up to the bed. Dieter feels something at his arm for just a moment, the infusion pump. Maybe a small sound, then nothing. Then his heart starts to beat out of time. In the last episode, we talked about a man who sprinkled poison onto his co-workers' lunches, about heavy metals that accumulate silently and patiently inside the body. About the long, invisible stretch of time before anyone even thinks to start looking. Today it's different. Today we're talking about a man you would have trusted with your life. A man you would have been had to trust because you were sick. Because you were lying alone in a hospital bed. Because he wasn't the nurse and you were the patient. Niels Högl, a nurse. Working between 1999 and 2005 at two clinics in Lower Saxony, Germany. Convicted of more than 85 murders. Suspected in up to 332 cases. The most prolific serial killer in post-war German history. And the most disturbing thing isn't just what he did. It's that almost everyone around him knew. And stayed silent. Welcome to Deadly Connections. Before we get into the case, a brief personal note. My mother died in a hospital after a long history of medical errors, treatments that went wrong, moments where the system could have intervened and it didn't. I don't know with certainty what happened at the very end. I probably never will. This case hits differently than the last one. Not because the victims are less real. They aren't. And I'll be naming some of them today, but because this wasn't an outsider who found a way in. This was someone in a white uniform with a badge, with trust. That's Deadly Connections. Let's get into it. The case. Niels Högl grows up in Wilhelmshaven, a port city in northern Germany. He's an average student, plays soccer, no obvious red flags. His mother is a nurse. His grandmother is a nurse. The profession is in the family. In 1997, he completes his nursing training. 2 years later, he starts working at the Klinikum Oldenburg on the cardiac surgery intensive care unit. And this is where the story I'm telling you today begins. I want to stop for a moment at that image, cardiac surgery intensive care. This isn't just any ward. These are patients recovering from open heart surgery. People at their most vulnerable who need around-the-clock monitoring, whose lives literally depends on tubes and machines. And right in the middle of all of that, Niels Högl. The first few months go without incident. Högl is seen as engaged, capable, medically competent. Co-workers describe him as someone who steps up when things get critical, who's always ready. And then the critical moments start pulling up. an unusual number of patients go into sudden cardiac arrest during a shift. An unusual number need resuscitation, and Hügel is always there. First to the bedside, decisive, ready. They call him the resuscitation Rambo. At first it sounds like a compliment, but something isn't right, and some of his colleagues can feel it. In August 2001, the ward holds a meeting. The agenda, the unusual high number of resuscitations and deaths over the recent months. Everyone attends, including Hügel. What happens next is one of the details of this case that stays with me the most. Hügel, apparently afraid of being called, calls in sick for 3 weeks after the meeting. And during his absence, the numbers drop significantly. His colleagues notice immediately. The shift supervisor at the time keeps a list, handwritten, internal. Next to every name on the ward, a number. How many times that staff member had been nearby when something went wrong. Next to most, zero. Maybe one or two. Next to Niels Hügel's name, 18. This list exists. It is documented in black and white. And what happens with it? Nothing. At first. Then, in September 2002, hospital management at Oldenburg loses confidence in Hügel. A senior physician informs him of this directly. But instead of contacting the police, instead of launching an investigation, instead of asking anyone outside the hospital whether something might be seriously wrong, management offers Hügel 3 extra months' salary and a reference letter. A good reference letter. He had performed his duties, quote, to our complete satisfaction. With that letter, Niels Hügel applies to the Klinikum Delmenhorst in December 2002 and gets the job. And keeps killing. In Delmenhorst, it starts immediately. New ward, new patients, the same pattern. Cardiac arrests, resuscitations, deaths nobody can explain. And Hügel, always in the middle of it all. On June 22nd in 2005, Niels Hügel is caught in the act. Colleagues observe him tampering with a patient's infusion pump, injecting the cardiac medication Gilurhythmal without any medical indication. Gilurhythmal. We'll look at that active ingredient closely in a moment. That day, Niels Hügel's active killing spree comes to an end. But the story doesn't end here. Not even close. What follows is a years-long, agonizingly slow journey through the justice system. One that shows the institutional failure didn't stop at the hospital doors. In 2006, the Oldenburg Regional Court convicts Hügel of attempted manslaughter. 5 years in prison, a lifetime ban from nursing. The prosecutor publicly states there is no evidence of connections to other deaths. No evidence, with 18 marks next to his name on a list. 2008. New proceedings. New verdict. 7.5 years. The lifetime ban stands. It isn't until 2014 that the Oldenburg prosecutor's office launches a serious investigation into the Delmenhorst cases. Hügel confesses. 30 murders at first. Then more. 2015, life sentence for 6 murders in Delmenhorst. 2018, new proceedings covering 97 additional cases. The trial is too large for a conventional courtroom. It's held at a convention center in Oldenburg. 120 co-plaintiffs, 80 members of the press. On the very first day of proceedings, Hügel confesses again. 2019, life sentence. 85 murders. Exceptional gravity of guilt. 332 cases investigated in total. 332. The motive, and this, as we saw in episode 1, is a bitter constant, was never fully established. The prosecution points to boredom and the hunger for recognition. He wanted to be the hero, the rescuer, the one who triggers a cardiac arrest and then brings the patient back, or tries to. In many cases, he failed. And then there's that other trial, the one against his colleagues and supervisors. Four former staff members were charged with manslaughter by omission. Not for killing anyone themselves, but because they could have stopped it, because they had the information, because they stayed silent. The verdicts in that case are complex and contested, but the question it raises can't be dismissed. At what point does silence become complicity? We'll come back to that at the end of this episode. Chemistry. In episode 1, we talked about poisons that come from outside. Heavy metals someone secretly sprinkles onto food. Substances the body doesn't recognize and can't make sense of. Today it's different, and in some ways that makes it more disturbing. Iamaline, a trade name Gilurit Mal, is not an environmental toxin, not an industrial product, not something you order online with a fake name. Iamaline is a medication, a legitimate, approved cardiac medication used in emergency medicine. It sits in hospital storage rooms, it's kept within reach on intensive care units, and it saves lives when used correctly. Niels Högl knew exactly what he was holding. Let's start from the beginning. Iamaline is a plant-derived alkaloid, extracted from the roots of the Indian snake root, Rauwolfia serpentina. Plant-derived sounds harmless. It isn't. Nature produces some of the most potent toxins in existence. We'll be seeing that again in future episodes. Iamaline belongs to a class of drugs called antiarrhythmics, medications used to treat irregular heart rhythms. To understand how it works, we need to take a quick look at how the heart actually beats. The heart doesn't just beat spontaneously. It follows an electrical signal. Every heartbeat begins with a wave of electrical excitation that travels through the cardiac muscle tissue, from the top down, from the atria to the ventricles. That wave is generated by sodium ions flowing into the heart muscle cells. Fast, precise, rhythmic. Iamaline blocks exactly those sodium channels. It slows the flow of sodium ions. The heart becomes calmer, less excitable, slower, more controlled. For someone experiencing dangerous arrhythmia, that's the rescue. The medication reigns in an out-of-control heart. But what happens when a healthy or already weakened heart receives that break? When someone gets an Iamaline injection they don't need, far too much of it? Then the electrical system collapses. The heart loses its rhythm. It begins to fibrillate. Ventricular fibrillation, the uncontrolled, useless twitching of the heart muscle with no pumping function. Blood pressure drops. Within seconds to minutes, the patient loses consciousness. Without immediate resuscitation, death. This is not a slow, creeping poison like in episode 1. This is a targeted attack on the electrical system of an organ that doesn't forgive mistakes. And now we get to the part that really gets to me as someone with a biochemistry background. Högl didn't do this blindly. He knew the mechanism, he knew the dosage, he knew that an overdose would trigger ventricular fibrillation. And he knew something else, that what he was causing would have looked exactly like a natural cardiac arrest. A patient who is already ill, already lying in an ICU, suddenly goes into ventricular fibrillation. The alarm goes off, the team rushes in, and Niels Högl is first to the bedside. The rescuer. That was his motive, according to the prosecution. Recognition, the adrenaline rush, the feeling of being indispensable. He created the chaos he then wanted to resolve. Sometimes he resolved it, often he didn't. A brief note on a second substance. In some cases, sotalol was also detected. Likewise, an antiarrhythmic. Likewise, a sodium channel antagonist, similar mechanism. Whether Hoegel deliberately rotated between the substances to avoid detection or for other reasons isn't fully established from the public record. But the underlying logic is the same: medications that interfere with the heart's electrical system. Here lies the critical difference from episode 1. With heavy metals, we said the tools were sitting on a shelf. ICP-MS, hair analyzes, bone samples, precise methods that could have been used. The problem was that nobody thought to look. With iamaline, the problem is different, more fundamental. Iamaline has an extremely short half-life in the human body. It's metabolized rapidly, primarily by the liver, to roughly 90%. The pharmacological effect lasts only about 20 minutes, and what that means forensically is devastating. If a patient survives the injection by even one day, just one day, iamaline is no longer detectable in the body. This isn't theoretical. This is the reason so many of Hoegel's cases were never provable. Exhumations were ordered on multiple victims, and in most cases, no iamaline was found. Not because it wasn't there, because too much time had passed. Even in cases where patient died immediately after the injection, detection is difficult. Iamaline and its metabolites require targeted analyses, liquid chromatography, coupled with mass spectrometry, LC-MS, a precise method. But it has to be applied, it has to be ordered. Someone has to think of it. And that's exactly the problem. When a patient in an intensive care unit dies, nobody routinely orders a full toxicological workup. The death gets attributed to the underlying condition. The physician signs the death certificate. The body is buried. The window closes, often within hours. What would have helped? This is where the story gets bitter in a very particular way. Unlike with heavy metal poisoning, there's no chelating agent for iamaline overdose, no specific antidote that neutralizes the substance. Treatment is purely symptomatic. Stabilize the heart, rest the rhythm, maintain circulation. That means resuscitation, defibrillation, cardiovascular support medications. Exactly what's available on an intensive care unit. Exactly what Niels Hoegel himself performed. He held the only therapy that could have counted what he was doing. He decided who received it and how earnestly. He created the crisis and played the rescuer. That's not a medical observation. That's a psychological picture I can't just move past. There's a term for this type of perpetrator in the international literature. Hero syndrome. Angel of death. The perpetrator creates the emergency in order to be seen as the savior. This is not unique to this case. We'll be seeing similar patterns in future episodes. But none of that changes the fundamental truth. The therapy was there. The knowledge was there. The equipment was there. It was just in the wrong hands. I want to get back to a number. 18. That is the number of marks next to Niels Hoegel's name on that handwritten list from 2001. 18 times he was in close proximity when something went wrong. 18 resuscitations, cardiac arrests, deaths. Next to every other name on the wall, 0, 1, maybe 2. This list existed. It sat in a drawer. And Niels Hoegel went on to kill for 14 more years. I'm not saying that to be dramatic. I'm saying it because that number is all you need to understand the institutional failure in this case, before we even begin to break it down. Let's start with the people who were closest. Hoegel's colleagues Frank Laugstermann raises concerns as early as the year 2000 with the deputy chief supervisor. He says explicitly he believes Hoegel is deliberately harming patients. That's not a vague unease. That's a clear statement. What happens? Nothing. Other colleagues notice the pattern, the declining numbers during his sick leave, the rising rate when he's back. They gave him a nickname, Resuscitation Rambo. Later in Delmenhorst, the second one follows, Scythe Hoegel. They have nicknames for what he's doing, and they stay silent. I don't want to simply condemn that, because I think it's more complicated than COVID is. In a hospital, on a shift, within a team, making a serious accusation against a colleague is not a small thing. You need evidence. You risk your job. You risk your relationships with coworkers. You risk being seen as a snitch. Silence has many faces. Not all of them are malicious. But in the end, people died. And the silence contributed. The clinical system. This is where it becomes harder to excuse. In September 2002, hospital management at Oldenburg loses confidence in Högl. The data exists, the list exists, the correlation between his sick leave and the declining death rate exists. The decision? No police, no investigation, 3 months of extra salary and a reference letter. He had performed his duties, quote, to our complete satisfaction. The former CEO of the Oldenburg Hospital later acknowledged that there were people within the institution who believed that Högl was harming patients, but they had not wanted to, quote, create unnecessary disruption. Unnecessary disruption? The Oldenburg chief of police later stated that the hospital had prioritized its reputation over the investigation of patient deaths. I'll leave that there. It gets worse. During the later trial, it emerged that the Oldenburg Hospital had provided legally funded witness advisors to its staff, and that these advisors had apparently attempted to influence certain employees before they gave testimony. That's no longer negligence. That's active obstruction of justice. When Högl is caught in the act in 2005, investigations begin. That part works. But the Oldenburg prosecutor's office publicly states there is no evidence of connections to other deaths. At the same time, investigators from Delmenhorst are pushing from the very start for broader inquiries. One of them, Manfred Borchers, later testifies, "My colleague and I pushed for additional exhumations from the very beginning of the investigation. We could have resolved the full scope of this case back in 2006 or 2007. They weren't heard. Records and lists documenting deaths at the Oldenburg Hospital were only handed over to investigators long after the first murder, convicted in 2015. Nearly 10 years too late. The justice system. I want to go one level deeper, because I don't think this case is an outlier. I think it's a symptom. Hospitals are a hierarchical system. Physicians and nursing staff work under enormous pressure, understaffing, rotating shifts, constant overextension. In those structures, a culture of just keeping things running tends to take hold. Don't make waves. Don't cause disruption. Whistleblower protection in Germany was and remains legally insufficient. Anyone who had gone outside the institution back then would have faced serious professional consequences. That's not a hypothetical risk. That's structural reality. And then there is the question of death certificates. In Germany, when a patient dies in a hospital, a full toxicological analysis is not routinely ordered. The physician assesses the situation, records the most likely cause of death, and the case is closed. In the vast majority of situations, that's completely appropriate. But it means a perpetrator who operates within the medical system, who understands the causes of death and exploits them deliberately, has structural invisibility built right in. Niels Högl didn't invent that. He exploited it. At the end of this case, I'm left with a question I have no satisfying answer to. How many of the 332 investigated cases were actually his victims? We'll never know. The window for I am a lean detection has closed. The bodies have been buried. The memories have faded or were actively suppressed. 332 people. Families who will never get an answer. And somewhere in that, there's a very personal question I can't quite let go of. When someone dies in a hospital and the circumstances are never fully resolved, when do you stop asking? When is what you know enough? I don't know. I don't think you ever stop. What remains unanswered? A great deal. The actual victim count will never be established. The moral question about complicity can't be fully resolved through a court verdict. And Niels Hoegele himself, he confessed, he testified, he offered explanations. Boredom, the hunger for recognition, the adrenaline of resuscitations. But whether any of that fully accounts for it, whether that's the whole truth, I don't think he understands it completely himself. Some questions don't have answers. They only have layers. Somewhere in Wilhelmshaven or Oldenburg or Delmenhorst, there are families who will spend the rest of their lives not knowing for certain whether their father, their mother, their grandfather really died from his underlying condition, or whether, on a Monday evening during the night shift, he crossed paths with a man who injected a cardiac medication into a pump. That not knowing is its own form of damage, one that no conviction can heal. Niels Hoegele is serving a life sentence with exceptional gravity of guilt. The Federal Court of Justice has upheld the verdict. The Oldenburg Hospital still operates. Hospitals across Germany still operate. The nursing profession still exists, practiced by hundreds of thousands of people who do exactly what the profession is meant for. Saving lives. That's important to say. This case is an extreme exception. But it's also a mirror for the structures that make exceptions possible when no one is watching. I've spent this episode talking about a system that stayed silent. I've also spent it thinking about my own story. About open question, about questions I carry and will never be able to resolve. About moments where the system could have intervened. I'm not saying that to ask for sympathy. I'm saying it because I believe this podcast, in cases like this one, only makes sense if they reach past the spectacle. If they leave a question behind. For me, it's this one. How much trust does a system deserve that has learned to look the other way? I don't have an answer, but I haven't stopped asking. In the next week, we'll leave Germany. We go to London, 2006. To a hotel room, to a man who is dying slowly and who knows it better than anyone, to a substance so rare, so targeted, and so unmistakable that it doesn't just kill a person, it sends a message. Alexander Litvinenko, Polonium 210. Deadly Connections. See you next week.